Gabriel program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Your 50,000-watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, that includes the home of Paul Leffler, Los Banos, and for Bulldogs fans now filling my email box with their thoughts on Wednesday night's opponent at Save Mart Center, Boise State, CGP at 940ESPNFresno.com. This is 940 ESPN, and you might be listening on 940ESPNFresno.com. Your three-hour tour begins right now. 6 minutes, 32 seconds past the hour of 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I am obviously the host of the program, for better or for worse, Christopher Gabriel. Delighted to be with you. Gorgeous day here in the Central Valley. I hope your week is off to a terrific start. Technical director, producer, hockey guy, Sharks fan, Giants fan. He's counting down the days, pitchers and catchers. Russ, keeping things rolling in the right direction. On the program today, bottom of the hour, Tony D, as he joins us the way he always does at Mondays at 3:35. Lots to talk about with Tony. We'll talk some Fresno State basketball, a little bit of the NBA action from the weekend as well. 4:05, Cam Worrell. Did you get a chance to see any of the new AAF? Are you engaged at all to watch the Alliance? You know, the NBA, they like to call themselves the Association, so the AAF is just the Alliance. Have you joined the Alliance yet? Are you buying in? Are you into it? Did it take one game for you to say, I am done with the NFL, I'm with the Alliance? Or are you making room in your heart for a little more professional football, and will there be room for the XFL relaunching next year? And then there's one more league getting started with through a number of former players. So you have three additional leagues getting going. We'll talk with Cam about that and several other things. 4:35, I'm sure you watched it, or maybe you're aware of it. You saw parts of it. And that is, of course, the Ramirez-Zepeda fight last night, late afternoon going into last night. At Save Mart Center, over 14,000 people turn out, just a great fight. It was a majority decision for Jose Ramirez. He holds on to his WBC World Championship junior welterweight belt. Renata Denseco had it 114-114. Chris Tellez had it 116-112. Glenn Trowbridge had it 115-113. And it was that close. Pete Lopes, one of the most savvy fight guys anywhere, he's going to be joining me in studio at 4:35. We're going to break it down. Well, we're not going to break it down. He's going to break it down. I'm going to give him what my impressions were of the fight and just how I thought Jose Ramirez did. Jose Zepeda was tremendous in that ring. He had some quirky things in his style, and I'm not sure. I mean, besides the fact that he's a southpaw, he had some quirky things that he was doing that I'm wondering if it was Freddie Roach who was, you know, trying to get him to do things to bait Jose Ramirez into different areas so that he would, you know, drop that left hand or drop a right hand or what have you, and just to expose himself. Jose Ramirez definitely took some shots. There's no doubt about that. But Zepeda took more. You look on the social media reaction to last night's fight, and there's certainly predictably, there were people saying that it was some home cooking, that Zepeda won the fight. I don't think Zepeda won the fight. Didn't think that for a second. Jose won that fight, but that it was a great fight. And one of the things that I'm curious to find out from Pete Lopes is the last two or three rounds. And again, I am by no means an elite boxing scoring mind. Let's just be very clear about that. I've watched a lot of boxing going back to the days of, you know, of Ali and Frazier, but I'm not a boxing scoring guy. But one of the things that I want to find out from Pete is those last two or three rounds, maybe even four rounds, but three in my mind were won handily by Jose Ramirez. And did we have what amounted to an even fight, a largely even fight up to that point? Because when you look at the scoring, when you look at how close these, I mean, one was 114-114, you know, on one card, Jose wins by 4 points and the other two. And I'm just wondering, you know, how he saw it versus those judges. So we'll get into that with Pete Lopes. But a tremendous fight. And at some point, I'm hoping that we'll get Rick Merigian back on the program and Jose Ramirez. I'd like to get Rick's view of you know what he saw ringside. We'll get Pete in a little while, but I'd like to get Rick's view as well because he spends so much time, obviously, managing Jose Ramirez. Top five at five, and then at 5:35. Always fun to have our friend from ESPN, Tom Van Herren, joining us. Tom is a college football recruiting guru, and you see him on ESPN all the time. And I want to talk with Tom about the transfer portal, and there's a lot of discussion about that. He is deeply in the weeds with this in terms of breaking it down. I also want to talk with him about the structural difference that we're at right now. We're not at a crossroads, but how he sees National Signing Day versus the early signing period. Because it used to be we geared up for National Signing Day. You remember, you're a college football fan. You geared up for that, waiting for Fresno State, or if your school, maybe Cal or Stanford or wherever it was that you attended, you waited for National Signing Day. Now, it seems somewhere on the order of 80 to 90% of the guys signing are signing in that 65 to 72 hour period in mid-December. And National Signing Day, while certainly there were some major recruits that got signed that were still out floating about, that day just doesn't come with the same anticipation, the same excitement that early signing period in December comes with. So we'll talk with Tom about that. We may also talk with him about cake. If you're wondering what I mean, just go to Tom's Twitter, and you will understand that. Tom, it's at Tom, V as in Victor, H as in Heron, or Van Heron. Also, I put a poll out, and it's going to be running through tomorrow. And I just want to bring it to your attention. You can find it at CG Program. I had a discussion with somebody about this today, early this morning, and so I just wanted to put it to the floor and see what people thought of this. And that is, when you send a text message, to a friend, okay, somebody that you know, and you're not asking a question. You're sending a text. Maybe I'll send a text to Paul, or I send a text to some of our technical guys, technical director and producer Russ, or to Bobby, or to Vivian, or to anybody, any of your friends. And you're not asking a question. You're throwing something out there. What I asked you in this poll is, should you expect a response? And I gave you four choices. Should you expect a response from a text when you're not asking a question? And the four responses I give you options on are yes, in less than an hour, yes, within 12 to 24 hours, third option is depends on who it is, and the fourth one, don't expect a response. Right now, depends on who it is has 42% of the vote, and then tied at 22% each, don't expect a response, and yes, in less than an hour, and then 14%, yes, within 12 to 24 hours. And I guess the conversation came up, and as I was talking with him, my friend, about this morning, I started to think about the people who I know pretty well, that sometimes I'll send a text to, that it may not be a question, but I'm looking for a little bit of dialogue at some point, and there's a couple of people who just never respond at all, until they have a question for me about something, which again, in the grand scheme of things, neither here nor there, not a big deal. But it was one of those things where, you know what, let's throw a poll up. So that's out there for you at CG Program. And you can, of course, you can always email me. You can always email the program CGP at 940ESPNFresno.com, and you can call the program. You can be on the program 844-940-3776. One story that is certainly dominating the landscape today is Kareem Hunt. Kareem Hunt gets signed by John Dorsey, general manager of the Cleveland Browns. On the football side of this, shouldn't be surprising. When he was in Kansas City, he's the guy who spearheaded drafting him. So now he's the GM at Cleveland with the Browns, and he's brought him there. And some might look at this, before we get into the off-the-field stuff, some might look at this as, well, you've got Nick Chubb there. What do you need another running back for? Well, you can look at some teams around the league right now. Look at the Saints. You know, look at the Saints with Ingram and Kamara. Look at the Bears with Howard and Cohen. I mean, you've got guys, you've got teams that have not just those two teams, but you have more and more teams with several multi-dimensional backs, guys who can bring it out of the backfield, guys who can catch a pass out of the backfield. And so, in one respect, that's where I can certainly see what he's doing. That is not to be interpreted as I think Kareem Hunt should be back in the National Football League. Everybody has a different view on this. Some agree with that, some will agree with that, some will not agree with it. Put me in the camp that says, yeah, I'm all for guys getting a second chance. That doesn't mean the second chance comes on the football field. I mean, you have John Dorsey's statement. Let me see if I've got that here. John Dorsey's saying, my relationship and interaction with Kareem since 2016 in college was an important part of this decision-making process. But we then did extensive due diligence with many individuals, including clinical professionals, to have a better understanding of the person he is today and whether it was prudent to sign him. There were two important factors. One is that Kareem took full responsibility for his egregious actions and showed true remorse. And secondly, just as importantly, he's undergoing and is committed to necessary professional treatment and a plan that has been clearly laid out. Well, number one thing that I would say right off the bat is that this is a guy who lied to his team, said he never left his hotel room. And I guess Kareem, and I'm just speculating now, I'm guessing Kareem in the hotel, ironically enough, in Cleveland, I guess he didn't think that there was a security camera that was going to be catching what was going on. And maybe he didn't think that was ever going to come out. I don't know. But, you know, there was another incident where he punched a man in June, I believe it was, but there was no videotape. So it's not his first brush with something violent. In this case, kicking, shoving a woman. You had the statement from Kareem Hunt, who said the following. I'll read this to you. First off, I'd like to once again apologize for my actions last year. What I did was wrong and inexcusable. That is not the man I was raised to be. And I've learned a great deal from that experience and certainly should have been more truthful about it after the fact. I'm extremely grateful that John Dorsey, D, and Jimmy Haslam and the Cleveland Browns organization are granting me this opportunity to earn their trust and represent their organization in the best way possible on and off the field. I'm committed to following the necessary steps to learn and to be a better and healthier person from this situation. I also understand the expectations that the Browns have clearly laid out and that I have to earn my way back to the NFL, because he is still indefinitely suspended. And when he comes back, he'll be on the commissioner's exempt list, and then we'll see where it goes from there. You're not going to see him in preseason games with the Browns. It's just not, it's just almost completely unlikely you're going to see that happen. I'm a work in progress as a person, but I'm committed to taking advantage of the support systems that I have in place to become the best and healthier version of myself. Listen, I think that's great. What he's saying is great. But for a league, and again, you can agree or disagree with this, but for a league that is steadfastly and quite publicly against any kind of domestic or sexual violence, we can include assault in this as well, I believe. They bring him back the Browns bring him back on $1 million contract, and it seems that many times what teams say they're going to do is not exactly what they do. And many times where a player's position is at with a given situation seems to be, at least we've seen that recently, seems to be predicated on whether or not there's pictures or whether there's a video. Joe Mixon comes to mind. You know, Ray Rice and the league were almost defiant amidst the lying that went on with what happened with his, you know, then fiance in the casino elevator. And I will say till my last breath on this planet that the NFL knew darn well about that second video. The NFL's not idiots. They might act that way sometimes, but they understood that there was another video, because elevators in casinos, elevators in big fancy hotels, and elevators in even not so fancy hotels have security cameras. So the for anybody to have presumed that there wasn't a camera in there was ridiculous. And Kareem Hunt should have thought the same thing. But I'm not a fan of this, and I'm not a fan of fans saying, well, there were no charges filed. There was no arrest. So in other words, you could watch a video of someone beating the hell out of someone, but for whatever reason, there wasn't an arrest, there weren't charges filed, and you would be saying, well, there was no charges filed, so what's the big deal? Let him back on the court. Let him back on the field. Let him back on the ice. I think to fall back on that, or the other common line that I've read endlessly today, well, she brought it on. She brought it on. He should know better. Okay? And the fact that it's a woman is terrible. But assault is assault. You know, you're a big, tough, strong. He might not be big, huge, tall guy, but he's big and strong. He's a tough guy. And for people to say she brought it on, what about her? I don't know how many times I read fans saying, what about her? Where's her culpability? Yeah, you know what? I don't care. I unless she's waving a gun or a knife at him and it's self-defense and it's life and death, that's a different story. Because there's a lot of people who have conflated that. This was not a life and death situation. I think it's pretty clear when you look at the video. At what point do we allow common sense to enter the public debate forum? At what point do we allow a little bit of common sense to say, you know what? He shoved her. He kicked her. He was out of control. You know, if you want to go the route and say maybe the Chiefs, instead of just dumping him off the team, if you really want to go and say they should have suspended him and then waited for the entire investigation to be done before deciding on anything else, I would have even said, you know what, that's even acceptable. But the excuses that we are willing to make for somebody who has acted really badly are out of control. And my view is also informed by the fact that I have two daughters. You know, for the people who say, yeah, I got a daughter, but it wouldn't make any difference, that's garbage. That's a bunch of nonsense. If you really feel that way, that if you have a daughter and that wouldn't matter to you, then maybe you need to work on your parenting skills. If you want to weigh in, you're certainly more than welcome to. 844-940-3776. Because plenty of people think it's cool. And you might be one of them. And I'm not going to try to talk you out of it. That's not my job. My job is to give you my opinion. My opinion is that Kareem Hunt should not be playing in the Cleveland Browns. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Bottom of the hour, we talk with Tony D, as we always do on Mondays. You know, one of the things, and a lot of times fans, neighbors, coworkers will say, well, this is an unfair parallel, so you can't really use it. But I would offer you this. Think about where you're listening to me right now. Maybe you're in your office. Maybe you're at home. But most of you listening to me work. And you're at work, or you left work, or you're on your way to work. And just imagine, gentlemen, that you decided to shove multiple times and then kick a coworker, you know, or punch a coworker, you know, pick anything physical like that. You're not going to be working there in the next, 90 seconds to 2 minutes. You're done. You're fired. And you're not going to be going back. Now, you can extend that parallel out a little bit and say, well, that may not preclude you from getting a second chance somewhere else. And you're right, except for the fact that in the real world beyond professional sports, that new job that you're applying to will ask on the application, as every application does, reason for leaving or reason for being dismissed. If you tell the truth, well, I had a physical altercation with a woman in the office or a man. It's reasonable to assume that your prospective new employer is going to contact that employer and say, what happened? Well, Mr. Smith, he actually shoved one of our female employees into a wall, and then as she was collecting herself, he kicked her while she was on the ground. So with the new job you're applying to, do you think you're going to get hired there? It's more than likely that you're not. More than likely that you're not. Somebody, sooner or later, will hire you. But this idea that we're so fast to try and blame someone else. Well, what about her? She shoved him. Well, she pushed him off, so she could just go up and do that. Come on. I just think there's got to be a level of accountability and responsibility. And the look, a lot of people don't like the word optics, but, you know, it applies here. You know, you have an incident that took place in a Cleveland hotel, and now you have the Cleveland Browns signing him to a $1 million deal. Meanwhile, Josh Gordon, they traded Josh Gordon out of there, did they not? Didn't they trade him? Yeah. They traded him out of there to the Patriots. You know, he had a number of issues. They gave him multiple chances. So, I guess, and I'm purely speculating here, that the Browns, the Haslam family, Jimmy Haslam, is essentially saying this situation, you know, stands on its own, meaning, Josh Gordon. And that's one thing. We had to get rid of him, but Kareem Hunt we're okay with. I'm not sure how you can wrap your arms around both of those if Josh Gordon was sent packing for a variety of different things, different issues completely. I'm not sure what your thinking is, what their thinking is on Kareem Hunt. And, I mean, if you really want to weigh everything into this, how does the NFL view Kareem Hunt potentially getting back on the field? But nobody will even give Colin Kaepernick a look. I mean, both situations, the Kaepernick situation eventually got to a point where the potential PR nightmare for bringing him in is out of control. But if you really want to get to the root of it, of his knee, things he said, you can disagree with that completely. You cannot like the knee. You cannot like his position, what he was saying. Fair enough. Are you also just as frustrated, angry, concerned with Kareem Hunt, or are you okay with that? Because if you're going to tell me that it was two different things, well, you're right. So on balance, if one has ostensibly been kept out of the National Football League, why is it okay for somebody who did something, in my book at least, much worse than taking a knee, that he's going to be, sooner or later, going to be welcomed back in? I have to get a thought from Tony D on this as well. Tony D is up next. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Working our way through hour number one. Brand new week. CGP, glad to have you aboard. Top of the hour, we'll talk with Cam Worrell, as we always do. Right now, our very good friend, Mr. Diodato, Tony D. Tony, how are you, my friend?
Just fine, CG. How are you?
Doing very well. Before we talk a little basketball, a little Fresno State basketball, maybe some NBA, I spent the first couple of segments talking about the Kareem Hunt situation, and there's so much. Well, you and I could spend another hour just talking right. about this. But I'm curious where you're at with it. You might be somewhere completely different than I am. I'm not a fan of where you have, one of the things I'm not a fan of is when I read people saying, well, there were no charges, there was not an arrest, so there shouldn't be an issue. And I think if we do that, the example I gave is, well, then would you be okay with a videotape showing somebody beating the hell out of someone, but no charges, no arrest? You're okay with that?
Yeah, I think that's probably the most rational way to look at it, that whether someone is charged or not is not the issue if you have video evidence. If it's a he said, she said, or a he said, then that's different. But when you have tangible proof, I don't think you can say, well, just because you weren't charged. It's very similar to somebody who is fined by the league office for a hit on Wednesday. They get the fine when in reality they weren't flagged on it on Sunday. It doesn't mean it didn't happen. It just meant they didn't catch it at the time.
Yeah, and I mean, this is one of those issues that comes with the caveat of there's not going to be consensus. There's going to be people who think it's perfectly fine for a Kareem Hunt to jump right back on the field. He won't be jumping back on the field just yet, you know, when training camp starts in August. And there's others who don't think that he should get back on the field.
Yeah.
It's really that simple. But the irony that I have for this whole thing, Tony, and then we'll just move on, is that it was the Browns signing him, and this happened in Cleveland.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of ties between where Kareem Hunt grew up. You know, we were familiar with him because he was a great player at Toledo and Fresno State played against him, and then we saw what happened with the Chiefs. But you also have someone now in Cleveland who drafted him in KC. So there's a lot of intertwining that is being done right now, and it is something I'm sure if you are around the Cleveland area that the opinions are real intense. And one of the things that you can't escape, CG, and I know you're aware of it, is do you have a team in the Cleveland Browns, and I'm just asking this for anybody to mull over, filing their ethics and their morals at the door because they feel like they're that close to being a viable playoff team for the first time in a long time? I would hate to think that's the main motivation, but it has to come up in conversation.
Well, there's no question, and I raised the point, and then we will move on here. I raised the point that a lot of teams in different sports will have that position. They'll take the position of not in our house, we're not going to do that, and then
right. You
will see exceptions to that policy made when a team is that close. Or they do need that point guard, they do need that power forward, or they do need that running back. And we've seen time and time again that teams suddenly say, well, this situation is a little different.
Particularly a guy who's young like
yes.
this. I mean, you know, and I know you and I have talked about the Ray Rice thing before, and I know you brought it up, that Ray Rice was disposable. And in a way, here's what is very interesting about the Ray Rice situation. Because he at least outwardly reconciled with the victim of his violence, because Ray Rice could no longer make that living, that impacted her financially as well. If this would have been a young Ray Rice, would this have played out differently? And you can make the argument that Kareem Hunt is just that, right? A young, productive Ray Rice, and that's why it's playing out differently. And I know you brought it up, and you can't escape it.
Nope.
I mean, even if the front office of the Cleveland Browns, in their heart of hearts, thought that this young man was contrite and deserved another chance, you cannot escape the implication of what they're doing. There's no way you can do that.
No, absolutely not. So traversing to something a lot lighter and a lot easier to discuss, Saturday night at Thomas & Mack Center, you had a crowd, a nice crowd, 8,324. That was that actually was about the same crowd that they drew or thereabouts for Nevada. Fresno State goes in, plays exceptionally well. Four guys come out of there in double figures, led by Braxton Huggins with 31, and then are given a gift with San Diego State beating Utah State, and where you had fans, I heard from some, essentially jumping off the bandwagon. Well, they're probably going to drop all the way down to the sixth seed. CG, you said that. I was like, no, I didn't say that. I said they're one game away from going past the top five. But suddenly, Tony, the Bulldogs are right back in the thick of things. They're tied with Utah State, and they've got the old nemesis. Doesn't make a difference if it's football or debate. Boise State's coming in Wednesday night.
You know, you look at the timing is everything, right? Who you play, you know, it's when you play them and where you're going to play them that is so important. And you get Boise on the bit of a downswing right now, and you get them at home. You get, you said, the opportunity now to solidify your other side of the bracket, 2 seed, 2 and 3, basically the same. But it does give you a chance to build some more momentum before you get to the Lawler Center on the 23rd. So I would think, and I was talking to Leppler about it last hour, I would think that Fresno State will take care of these remaining home games. The issue is going to be what they do on the road. And the other thing is the good news and bad news. The good news of Utah State losing, the bad news is San Diego State suddenly is jumping up front and center. They wanted Boise a week ago. And so you wonder if the Aztecs are going to be the royal pains in the rear end they usually are come March, come tournament time.
Yeah, and you look at Utah State, and it seems that they have a few more games, a couple more games at home than they do on the road, but their schedule isn't a cakewalk. I mean, they're going to end their last game of the year, the regular season, is at Colorado State, but the three games before that in a row at Boise State, and then back-to-back home games against San Diego State and Nevada. So yeah. there's a lot of basketball. We said this after the New Mexico game, that there's just a lot of basketball to be played, and there's no conclusions to be drawn yet as to who's going where and who's going to be seeded what.
Yeah, the only thing you know in this conference is, barring the catastrophic, Nevada is going to be in the big dance. Beyond that, you don't know if anybody else is going to get in conference-wise. You don't know. It would appear it's going to come down to the three games in March, I guess four for certain games. But realistically, I think we know that somebody coming out of the pigtail round probably isn't going to win the tournament. It's going to come down to the 3 days in March, and we're back to that same thing, CG, you and I talk about. Is that the right thing to do? Should your entire conference be down to a conference tourney? I know the argument. The argument is you have three chances. One, the overall body of work that starts in November. Two is play great in conference. Win the regular season title, you might get there, and then three is your fallback. But your fallback actually becomes the only auto bid, so that becomes even more complicated, doesn't it?
It really does, and I the conference that I think of immediately when we talk about this, is just because of being in the Midwest for so many years, is the Missouri Valley Conference. Because,
yeah,
you know, they had years where before they left the conference, Wichita State was dominating that conference for a while, but Illinois State had some great teams. Southern Illinois had some great teams. You had a situation where a lot of times if one of those other teams wasn't upsetting Wichita State and winning the conference, or St. Louis had some, the Billikens had some good teams. What is a Billiken? They were having some good years. And they were just getting overlooked. Meanwhile, the SEC would be getting 7, 8, 9 teams in. The ACC was getting 10 teams in. And I think sometimes, and I know it's an old argument, Tony, and we hear it discussed on CBS and ESPN every year, but the reality is there are high-quality teams in a Mountain West, in the Missouri Valley Conference, in the American Conference, that get overlooked because of the lure of the other schools that are on their big TV contracts, and we're seeing them much more often. Utah State and Fresno State, from what I've seen from both teams and looking at the way the landscape is right now, one of those teams, in my view, if they continue to play the way they're playing, should get a bid, and they probably won't.
Yeah, I would agree, and it's not just, you know, provincial look at this thing. One of the things, and you and I have talked about football and the difference, and we know this, the difference with the big boys is, and there's a legitimate statement, it doesn't, you know, the UCFs of the world didn't like it, and I think Fresno State probably didn't like it either because they're mid-majors, but when you say to somebody, look, you played great in your conference, but if you had to play in the SEC, by depth alone, you would get yourself by attrition worn down. I think we agree, grudgingly agree with that. the difference in basketball, CG, you have to look at it because you have a single elimination six game or more opportunity in front of you in March. If a team is capable on a given day, not to win the whole thing, but on a given day to beat anybody in the country, they deserve to be in the tournament. I mean, that's how I view it, right? Nevada is certainly that way, and I think Fresno State, on a given day, is capable of playing with anybody in the country one time, one shot. They're not going to win a national championship, but you know what? With the way the Bulldogs shoot the three, you get in a scatter game, I don't care if you're Duke, you could have a full 40 minutes against Fresno State. That kind of team I'd like to see in the tournament. Not that I think they're going to have a parade afterward, but it's a lot of fun to watch them on that given day.
No, you're absolutely right. And we listen, you mentioned Duke. I'll bring Tennessee into this discussion as it applies to our discussion about Fresno State, and you'll see why. There are a lot of skeptics around the country right now. There are just so many skeptics about Tennessee being number one in the country and what have you. And you look at what the Vols have done so far this year, and they have an 18 game winning streak. The only loss they had was in overtime to Kansas, a game that they not should have won, but a game that they could have won. They're 22-1. They beat a number one Gonzaga team. They've played a good schedule. They've not played the schedule Duke is, but, and this is the point, most basketball observers who haven't paid attention, the people who are going by name only, will look at Duke and say, "Well, Tennessee's not as good as Duke," and they're probably going to get their butts handed to them at Rupp Arena on Saturday night. But that's fans and that's analysts who are looking at the name Tennessee and not paying attention to the team, because Tennessee historically doesn't have a great basketball team. Similarly, you look at the Mountain West Conference, and you look at Utah State, you look at Fresno State, not necessarily San Diego State, but those two schools, and they don't just come rolling off your tongue when you're talking about college basketball, but to the person who's watching a little more closely, it's absolutely what you just said a minute ago, that they can beat virtually anybody on any given night if you have a night where Huggins is hitting, Deshaun Taylor's hitting, if you're getting contributions from Blackwell and Bittner, and Nate Grimes is playing big in the middle and not getting in foul trouble, they can beat just about anybody, especially in a given format of, you know, win and move on or lose and you're done.
Yeah, and you know, and also capable of being beaten by 40 or losing to a lesser team. And this, and by the way, I do not want this to turn into this referendum that I'm about to throw out, because I've gone through it before, because I called the games for a lot of years. I love women's basketball. I've said this before about women's sports, two of them. Women's volleyball is superior to men's college volleyball because there are more rallies in women's college volleyball than men. It is serve and pound real hard from well above the net, so you don't get a lot of play. You get the equivalent of tennis to serve and volley all the time. Basketball-wise, aesthetically, the game is more aesthetically pleasing because it's designed to be played above the rim, more aesthetically pleasing to watch the men's game. It doesn't mean the women's game isn't compelling, but it means that's the reason the WNBA, where it's just for entertainment, not for your school, right? Why the WNBA is not as popular as the NBA. It doesn't mean there aren't quality athletes. It's an evolutionary process. I bring it up, CG, because in the women's game, because the depth is not there yet, it's going to take generations. It's getting better. You cannot put a Fresno State up against a UConn or a Notre Dame and think they're going to have any shot in the world. They're going to lose by 40 or 50, and that goes to a lot of clubs across the country. Not the case in the men's game. The men's game has been around long enough that the Butlers of the world or the Fresno on a given night can beat somebody, and that's what makes it so compelling to me and so unfortunate when they don't have a chance to get into the tournament.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you're talking to somebody who, you know, has been a Tennessee Lady Vols fan. They still go with the Lady Vols. I'm not a fan of that. I watched all of Pat Summitt's 8 championships, and you watch UConn and their 11 championships, and Notre Dame's found their way in, and South Carolina and Mississippi State. But on balance, what you're saying is spot on, because there is an abundance of talent in the men's game that can, you know, there's 350, 360 Division I programs, and probably two-thirds of those could beat, you know, a big-time top 10, top 15 program on any given night if everything's going right. The chasm between the haves in women's college basketball, which is about 8 or 10 programs out of the other 2 or 300. It's an enormous valley. You're right. Fresno State, if they went up to Gampel Pavilion in Storrs, Connecticut, this game is over in 5 minutes. It's over and done with. That the gap is too large, and until there are more women playing the game, that the upper echelon of talent in women's basketball is fantastic, but that pool, Tony, that big box needs to get bigger because there's not enough to go around.
And it's an evolutionary process. In 100 years or so, it will get there. It just takes time. It takes time, and particularly when you have a school like UConn or a Notre Dame who has stepped up, where they're able to draw from that limited talent pool. You know, let's face it, when the Diana Taurasis are leaving SoCal to go all the way across the country, there's something going on here. Yeah. In the men's game, you have enough Diana Taurasis, you're okay, right?
Right.
But Diana, throughout her college career and then her great pro career, she became the exception rather than the rule. And so I'm not denigrating the game. The women's college game is terrific because you have the loyalty to your alumni base. That's what makes it great. The WNBA has to be about the actual aesthetic of the game. It will take time, and I'm not demeaning the game, but you're right. Chasm is the proper word. It's why I'm not pining for Fresno State to play UConn in the NC2As in the women's game. I'd love to see the men get a shot at the top five team on a given night, and let's see what happens. They might lose by 40, but then again, they might not.
Yeah,
that's what I'm intrigued by.
That's right, and that's also one of the biggest reasons the women's college tournament still has the pods where a team has to put a bid in, but the top seeded team in each little four team region is playing. I mean, they're playing at home because they know that if you separated it out and you had regional sites and you had games that were not on campuses, you're not going to get anybody there because the disparity between the upper echelon teams and the ones who are not there, they're going to draw 500 people. At least you're getting attendance when you get these big-time programs. And yeah, definitely not. I love women's college basketball, and I enjoy watching Jamie White's team play. And I think she is a terrific young coach and somebody who's going to take this program places. But, you know, there was a time when it was USC and it was UCLA. You know, you had UCLA winning a title. You had Cheryl Miller and USC winning a title. Mm-hmm. And you had very few programs around the country that were winning, and then suddenly Tennessee gets going. But even when in Pat Summitt's years, when Tennessee was winning those titles, Gino Auriemma was just starting to get there, and then he finally did in her last two or three. There were still, you could name them. I mean, Stanford put Stanford in that group. Rutgers is in that group. Iowa was in that group. But you're
Old Dominion for a while, time ago.
Yes, exactly.
Also, I want to mention this quickly, not to interrupt you, CG, but Fresno State in 1990 upset then number two UNLV. UNLV had the number one men's team in the country, of course, and went on to win the national championship right in 89-90 under Tark. But the women were number two, and Fresno State upset them at the North Gym. One of the greatest nights I've ever seen in women's basketball. You could not ask for better theater. 2,000 people packing that place, number two team in the country. You didn't have to be playing for a national title. It was just a conference game, but it was enormously important. Would love to see that on a night-to-night basis.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And that's one of the places where the Save Mart Center sort of fails. The women's program, because they're never going to get 10, 12, 13,000 in there, and it's just not an intimate enough place. All right, we're running a little late because Tony and I, that's just what we do. We're Italian and a Greek, and we just talk a lot.
That's right. Where's the food in the Vito? Come
that's
on.
That's right.
Or the Ouzo, whatever you want.
You know, right. Flaming Ouzo shots. We can have those lined up at the break. Tony, always a pleasure. I'll see you on Wednesday, and then we'll talk new Friday emails this week.
Look forward to it, my friend. Take care. Have a great one.
There you go. Tony D, this is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Just a sidebar for you as we end the hour. Whenever I get pizza, I've got my two or three places in town that I like to go. But sometimes, for a quick snack, the kids, this and that, I like to have some frozen pizzas in the fridge. What is it about this area that I cannot find sausage pizzas, frozen sausage pizzas? Why is that? Oh, I can see sausage with Canadian bacon and what have you. I can see sausage and pepperoni. But a friend just sent me a picture of a freezer in a store, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cases open on the side of sausage pizzas. Fresno, I ask you, where are your frozen sausage pizzas? And again, I 99 times out of 100, I'm going to go to my favorite places. But just to have a snack or two at home on that late night, I just want to know where I can buy a frozen pizza that's sausage. Not sausage and something else. Thin crust, please. I just want to know. CGP at 940ESPNFresno.com. Coming up, Cam Morrell. We're going to talk about, they call themselves already, they've shortened their name, the Alliance. The Alliance of American Football. Are you in? Are you out? You tell me. This is the CGP.
The studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two, CGP, begins right now. 5 minutes, 32 seconds past the hour of 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Glad to have you aboard. Seeing North Carolina playing Virginia right now. Very, very early in that one. Darren tweeting me at CG Program. I thoroughly enjoyed the USFL and look at the Alliance in the same way. Palatable football. Palatable football until baseball season and hockey playoffs. I think one of the things with this league is going to be palatable football until March Madness. We'll see what happens there. But, you know, one person who we can ask some questions about and see what he thought. Well, he's up next.
He was a hard-hitting defensive back for Fresno State, the Chicago Bears, and the Miami Dolphins. And if you look at him wrong, he might just blindside you. Here's Cam Worrell.
Well, after a weekend in which I watched Cam's daughter, Paul Leffler's daughter, and my daughter's competing as well as being part of an exhibition of cheerleading, I don't think I've ever been around that many bows and makeup and just everything for 8 hours. It's taken me a while to sort of unwind and get that pulsating beat out of my head, even though it was great fun watching. We welcome Mr. Cam Worrell back to the program. How are you, my friend?
CG, I was disappointed. I missed the cheer competition Saturday. I was going to passing down tournament in San Francisco, but I did get to see my daughter perform Wednesday night, the routine that they performed on Saturday. I did not envy the fact that you just said you were there for 8 hours. That was not something that I would have enjoyed in any way, shape, or form.
Fortunately, they had food trucks and mini donuts.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they had, you know, they had lots of food and beverages out there.
Beer. Huh?
Back in New York, when I was in the New York Show Business Softball League in Central Park, you'd be out there and you'd be playing, and then you had guys walking around literally with black hefty bags, just walking around going, beer, beer, beer. And you know, it didn't matter that it wasn't all that cold. You just said, how many are on our team? Yeah, give us 18 of them. And, that's what we did. I will tell you that, and I know that, you know, both of us have daughters who are involved in this stuff. I love watching these young girls. They work so hard, and they're so good at what they do, whether it's the pep girls, you know, the dancing. My older daughter does that. My younger one does the pep and the cheer. I saw your school's, your school perform. These kids are a joy, they have so much fun, and, man, they just rock the joint. They get people into it.
Yeah, they do. Look, that was the first cheer performance that I had ever been to on this level. Actually, I think I back my older daughter did one 2 years before, but it was a little smaller scale. The one we went to Wednesday, Granite Ridge performed, Clovis North performed, and that pep stuff is legit, man. Mm-hmm. To get 12 to 15 girls or 8 to 10 girls, whatever it is, to be uniform in their movements and the complexity of skills that they executed, I was really shocked. And I know Granite Ridge has a nationally renowned pep team, and you could tell when you watched them, you were like, man, I can't imagine how many hours these girls put in to perform this way. That was impressive. It was really eye-opening for me to see just how skilled and dedicated those performers were.
Well, yeah, and you're talking about nationally recognized. Last year, for one of the big sort of exhibitions that they had at that theater up at Clovis North, you know, one of the Clovis, I think it was the Clovis West competition pep team, won the national championship. And I'm thinking, well, I mean, okay, I've been watching some great dancers and stuff all night, and how good could they be? And it was only like five of them on this team. And my gosh, I it was just stunning. And you hit the nail on the head. How absolutely flawless, whether you're talking about a Clovis West or Clovis North or Granite Ridge or Kasner, whatever school you're talking about, the hours and hours that these girls put into it, I mean, it's just so impressive. And you know what, Cam, when you watch the cheer part of it and the lifting the girls up and what, anybody who wants to, go ahead and at me if you want to tell me that this isn't a sport, because it is.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. The skills that are executed, the you know, not just the complexity of the routines, because they're very complex, and they're like 2.5 minutes long, the competition routines, but the you know, aerobatics that are done, the flips and you know, girls being thrown in the air and doing a flip and being caught by the same girls who threw. I mean, it's pretty fascinating, and it's 100% a sport, and I'm glad that the CIF recognized that, and now, you know, around the valley you do have competitive cheer that you can participate in.
Yep, it's great stuff. So I thought, you know, they deserve mention, and the fact that our guy Cam and Paul Leffler and myself all have kids involved in it, and I know a lot of you do as well. We just wanted to give these young ladies and some young men who are involved as well, give them their due, because not only do they put so many hours into it, but hey man, they are just as dialed into their middle schools and high schools and elementary schools as everybody else. So hats off to all of them. Fun competitions. All right. So the Alliance. We're already down to now we're just, you know, you got the NBA, you got the Association, and now we're down to the Alliance after one weekend. I've been getting emails about it. I went into this very skeptical, Cam. I had my doubts about it, and I watched a little bit of it. I watched more than a little bit of it. And while it wasn't clearly going to be football at the level of the NFL, I think with Charlie Ebersol, he's got a good approach here, and he certainly learned from a master, his father, Dick Ebersol, that they're not trying to replace the NFL. They're simply trying to be kind of their own entity. They had a lot of things that they did that I liked. There was a lot of hitting, which was great, but there was a lot of transparency with the officials, with the replay. I think there's something going on here that at least bears more watching. What was your takeaway?
Yeah, for sure. I think what you saw was, a football league built by very smart people who understand viewing something on TV. That's what I think. My biggest takeaway from the AAF was this weekend was it's fun to watch. You know, just everything that you said, the transparency of the replays. I think the rules on the field are set in a way that allows a little bit more contact. It's a little bit more open offensively. And Ebersol, he took everything that people complain about the NFL, and he tried to take those things out and make his product, you know, something that fans want to see. I think it's kind of a combination of college football and the NFL, where people watch college football because it's open, there are big plays, you know, there's not a ton of high-level execution compared to the NFL. And I think the AAF is kind of right in the middle of that. You're going to have some big explosive plays, but you're also going to have some guys who are getting after it physically, and they're going to allow that. So I think, I think we saw a league that I would say dramatically outlived what the expectations were going into it. Anytime you think of another professional football league you think of something that is a watered-down version of the NFL. This was not that at all.
No, no, it wasn't. For folks who didn't watch or haven't paid attention, there's eight teams. There's the Eastern and Western Conference. Atlanta, Birmingham, Memphis, Orlando are in the East. In the West, Arizona, Salt Lake, San Antonio, and San Diego, you have teams playing in as small a stadium, the Atlanta Legends, as Georgia State, a 24,000-seat stadium, and you have Birmingham playing at Legion Field, which seats almost 72,000, and you have the Alamo Dome hosting San Antonio at about 64,000. San Diego's playing at SDCCU Stadium, 70,000. I think, you know, Cam, you see this league, and it's definitely going to bear more watching, and you know, the overnight numbers, the rating was 2.1. They're looking at about 2.9 million people. It outpointed an NBA game. It's not anywhere remotely close to an NFL game. But again, we're talking apples and oranges here. That's the wrong comparison. Here's one of the initial concerns that I would have if I'm a part of that league. You know that you had a lot of people sampling them and you know, kind of kicking the tires a little bit to see where they're at. And now they're going to be only streaming. There's not going to be any network broadcast until April. Potentially that can hurt them a little bit, and it's going to, and maybe though, Cam, that was by design. They didn't, well, first of all, on CBS, they weren't going to be able to go head to head with the NCAA tournament, but maybe, you know, maybe that was by design that, you know, we're going to get folks interested, let them see what we're all about, give them a little taste, dip their toes in the water, and then we'll come back strong in April.
That's the way that it seems, and you know, I'm not an expert, obviously, in television trends and the thinking behind that. I would think when you have a big kind of introduction to the country on a network broadcast, that you would want to build on that momentum. I would think that, you know, the AAF is probably going to market themselves more toward younger viewers, more towards people who want to gamble on football. I think that's where you're going to get a lot of people who are interested once they understand who these teams are, who plays on them. I honestly don't know if Vegas had lines on these games or not. I think they did. I'm not 100%, though. That's where I think this is kind of skewing to, at least in this month or so that they're off, month and a half, 2 months that they're off, and then attack that network coverage once again. But it seems to me a little odd that they jumped on the scene like they did. And I think people are excited to see what this league's going to do, and now they're going to have to jump on an alternate device to catch them. So we'll see. Like I said, Charlie Ebersol knows way more about TV than I do. But I think a lot of people, you know, maybe a little bit older than us, I don't think they're going to find the AAF unless they really make an effort to do so. And I think when you're talking about just 3 million people, you might lose a portion of that.
Well, and you know, it's interesting you mentioned Las Vegas. So we're talking with Cam Morrell. We're talking about the AAF, the Alliance of American Football, now to be known as the Alliance. It's interesting that their championship game is on April 27th, and where is it going to be at? Sam Boyd Stadium, in Las Vegas. I don't know if going forward the idea was to plant their flag in Las Vegas, knowing that in 2020 you've got this $2 billion palace opening up as the home of the Raiders, and that they're going to use that as well for their own version of the Super Bowl. But what's going to be interesting, and let's just project ahead a little bit, Cam. Next year, the XFL, the revived, revisited, and renovated XFL opens up, and they're going to be going head-to-head with this league. And then there's one more league that's going to be starting up with a bunch of players, I guess, that are starting it. I think it might even be not even 11-man teams. I'm not sure. But I think when all is said and done, when the dust settles, all of these leagues are not going to survive.
No, unless they have a lot of financial backing and a lot of people with very long-term views of what this is going to look like. No, they can't exist. It costs so much to operate a football team. You know, even if you're paying guys, you know, small salaries compared to, obviously, the NFL, the XFL, to me, was always a gimmick. It was always... Yeah. They did things, just do them. They didn't make a whole lot of sense. When I watched the Alliance, they did things that were smart. I think they're trying to fill a need for football that doesn't exist during the spring and early summer or late, you know, late winter, early spring. I think that people want to watch that. They want to watch football, but they don't want to watch gimmicks. They don't want to watch stuff that's over the top mixed with WWE like the XFL was before. Maybe the XFL is not going to be that, but, you know, just seeing what I saw over this weekend, I think this was a league that has a lot of very smart people behind it who really understand, you know, what it's going to take to survive as a professional sports league.
Hey, what do you think about some of these rules? If folks are visiting with Cam Morrell, as we always do on Mondays at 4:05, I like the fact that there's no extra points and there's different ways that you can score. No kickoffs. The defenses. You can't rush more than five guys on or across the line of scrimmage. I think you hit the nail on the head that Charlie Ebersol took what we have either complained openly about for a long time or grumbled just a little bit. We wish this change or that change. And I think what they're doing that's smart, Cam, is they're saying we have the latitude to test and measure. We're going to test and measure and see what works, what doesn't work. I think one area, there was clearly a lot more hitting and a lot more allowed, but I think the moment they get a serious, serious head injury, they're probably going to reel some of that in a little bit. But the pace of play, Cam, that's what really caught my attention. The pace of the games was, for I like a faster game, and it was superior to most NFL games.
Yeah, it was, and I think it's going to continue to do that. I honestly think, you know, if you're not trying to compete with the NFL, which no football organization that just pops up can, you know, I think you look at the gaps in what, you know, the NFL doesn't offer its viewers. And when you, I'm sure, look at the data, you know, throughout this last NFL season, you know, what were the biggest negatives on social media? What were the biggest negatives on you know, ESPN or some of that coverage after the fact? What were those, and how can we try to eliminate those from our game? How can we make our game not have those same issues pop up week after week after week? And I think they did that. They have an extra official, you know, up top who can make a decision on a call, who can make a call, not even on the field. They're doing some innovative things. Honestly, I think they're doing some things that the NFL will eventually embrace. The NFL is going to take the kickoff out as well. And the Alliance saw that. And I think, you know, they are a little bit ahead of the time with some of the way that their gameplay works on the field.
And having the eyes in the sky, this is where this was brought up at the State of the NFL address at the Super Bowl for Roger Goodell. And he said, I'm going to paraphrase, we're talking about human beings. What is another set of eyes going to do? But Roger Goodell was deft in the way he deftly handled that, because the question wasn't asked and with the presumption of having another official on the field. It was about having somebody in the sky, so to speak, up in the booth. And the idea that, how is that different than New York? Well, it is different. Because if you have 16 guys doing it versus one replay booth in New York, I think that makes a huge difference, Cam.
Oh, no question. And, you know, there's something to be said. We could watch replay after replay after replay. There's something to be said for somebody making that decision who watches that play live and in person and can get that viewpoint of it and then go back and look at what they need to look at to try to make a determination. I think it's so difficult for someone sitting in a control room, you know, absent the atmosphere, absent seeing something with their own eyes to make a decision on most of the time. I mean, I guess we have to take the Saints-Rams non-call out of it because that was as egregious as you'll ever see. But most of the time, I mean, when you slow it down frame by frame, you can see obvious penalties. But if you watch it in full speed, you know, 90% of us would miss a call. You know, if we threw a flag, we'd make the wrong assumption on what really happened. And I think someone sitting and looking at that type of footage, it's difficult for them to make the decision. But I think somebody sitting right there watches it live, can see how the players on the field reacted to what happened, and then go back and take another look. I think it's a huge advantage for the way that the Alliance runs that.
No question about it. One more segment coming up with our good friend Cam Morrell. I want to talk to him about the big announcement today from Kyler Murray. I don't think it's a big surprise. Nevertheless, we'll talk about it. I'll read you his very brief statement. That's next. Cam Morrell's joining us. I'm Christopher Gabriel. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel program right now on 940 ESPN.
Two guys who are regulars on this show. One of them, they're both elite boxing minds. One of them, Pete Lopes, Coach Pete, is going to be in here at 4:35. We're going to break down, well, he's going to break down the Ramirez-Zepeda fight. I've got a lot of questions. Him and I were just talking, nice to know that what I was seeing was what he was seeing, and he was about 10 feet away. That's coming up next. We're talking right now with our good friend Cam Morrell, of course, does superb work on the sidelines for Fresno State football broadcast with the voice of the Bulldogs, Paul Leffler, and, of course, the coach, Pat Hill. This is the statement from Kyler Murray. Cam, you've read it, I'm sure, but for everybody who hasn't heard it, it's very brief, and it's not a surprise at all. Kyler Murray, Heisman Trophy winner, Oklahoma starting quarterback, said this, "Moving forward, I am firmly and fully committing my life and time to becoming an NFL quarterback. Football has been my love and passion my entire life. I was raised to play quarterback, and I very much look forward to dedicating 100% of myself to being the best quarterback possible and winning NFL championships. I have started an extensive training program to further prepare myself for upcoming NFL workouts and interviews. I eagerly await the opportunity to continue to prove to NFL decision makers that I am the franchise quarterback in this draft." All right, Cam, I'll ask this as simplistically as I can, meaning try to be brief here as opposed to a two-minute question. A lot of folks dismissed Baker Mayfield going into that draft. I was not one of them. Neither were you. We talked a lot about him. Loved his leadership. Loved his ability to throw the deep ball, the over-the-middle pass, you know, laying it in over a guy's shoulder, going back shoulder on a guy, could use his legs when he needed to, but really could make all the plays. We saw him do that with Cleveland this year. Kyler Murray, I realize he's a couple of inches shorter, but I just wonder I think that he's going to be successful in this league. He's got something that I've not seen from a lot of quarterbacks in a long time. There is an explosion with this guy that even Baker Mayfield doesn't seem to have. Curious what you think about him choosing football.
Yeah, I think this is, I've always said that choosing baseball is a much better long-term proposition than choosing football, especially if you're a first-round pick, and, you know, you get $5 million guaranteed like Kyler Murray was going to get. It's a no-brainer to play baseball unless you're a quarterback. And unless you're going to be a first-round quarterback, baseball would be the logical choice. But Kyler Murray is going to be a top-10 pick. You know, he's going to make, you know, immediately 5 or 6 times what he would make as a baseball player, you know, in his first contract. So, for Kyler Murray, it's a no-brainer. Even if he never gets to that second contract, Kyler Murray will probably make, you know, more money in endorsements and guaranteed, you know, income in his first 5 years than he would in his first maybe 10 years, you know, playing baseball. So I think it's a no-brainer. I agree with you. I think, you know, the rules have changed so drastically over the last 10 years or so. Somebody like Kyler Murray can exist in the NFL, and he can use that explosiveness that, you know, the last person we saw like that was probably Michael Vick. He's the last really explosive 4-3 type elite athlete that we've seen at that quarterback spot. And I think Kyler Murray, even though he's 5'9", you know, he's so athletic, he'll get outside the pocket. The rules are in place to protect a quarterback like him. And just like Baker Mayfield, he's a winner. He hates to lose. He's going to be driven to prove everybody who doesn't think he can get this done wrong. And I think that's the type of person he is. That's the type of leader that I saw, you know, during this last season in the Heisman Trophy campaign at Oklahoma. I think that's the type of quarterback that the NFL is going to get when he gets drafted at the end of April.
Two quick things for you, and I'm going to give you the last word as always. One, I just wonder how many teams are going to pass on him and regret it later. But this is the point that I wanted you to comment on, about 60 seconds worth, and that is we get dialed in with measurables. We're always talking about measurables, but sometimes we are dismissing the importance of the eye test, and the eye test says this young man is going to be successful.
Yeah, there's obviously questions. You know, he's short. Can he survive the physicality of the NFL? Can he see through the line of scrimmage to make throws? Like, there are legitimate questions with Kyler Murray. But all you have to do is put the tape on. All you have to do is watch him shred college defenses. And honestly, one of the throws he made against Alabama, moving to his left, just the wrist flick of like 60 yards, I think that answers any questions that you have about Kyler Murray's ability to operate within the pocket and deliver a football pretty much anywhere on the football field. So I think he's exciting. I think he might be the most polarizing prospect that we talk about leading up to the draft. And you're right. If you're sitting at seven and you need a quarterback, you're going to pass on this guy. You're going to allow someone else the opportunity to pick, you know, somebody who, and I'm not, it's not hyperbole. He could literally change the way the quarterback position is played in the NFL because the rules will allow him to do so. And some smart offensive mind will get him and will build some very innovative things around here. So I'm excited to see this process play out.
Well, as always, very well said. Folks, this is why we have Cam Morrell come on. He just sets the bar, and we all just quiet down and have a sip of water, and we listen to him. Cam, always a pleasure, my friend. I know that football's over, but it really isn't, so we're going to keep finding ways to keep having you come on.
Sounds good, CG, man. You know I love it every Monday.
Appreciate it, my man. All right, there you go. Cam Morrell, I love it. Coming up, we're going to switch from football to another physical sport. We're going to go to boxing. We're going to look at Save Mart Center. It was a rocking, rollicking, raucous house last night at Save Mart Center for Jose Ramirez. I want to say it the way the announcer does. Ramirez. And Jose Zepeda. It was a majority decision, but within that, there's quite a bit to talk about, and we're going to talk about it with our guy, Coach Pete Lopes. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Huge fight last night. It was Jose Ramirez, Jose Zepeda. It was a majority decision for Jose Ramirez from Avenal. Your judges' cards, 114-114, 115-113, and then the one that even I kind of raised my eyebrows at, 116-112. Joining me, an elite boxing mind, and one of the two that I know in this Central Valley in terms of people who come on this show regularly, my good friend Coach Pete Lopes. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me.
All right. I don't even know where to jump in, so I'm going to jump in. This was a battle.
Definitely.
Last night, and there were times that as I watched this fight unfold, it was clear to me that as great as Jose Ramirez is, Jose Zepeda caught him on a number of occasions because I saw Jose Ramirez's head snapping back.
Right.
You didn't hear a lot of that from the announcers.
Right.
That's one thing I wanted to ask you about. The other is, and you made this point, and you'll elaborate on it, that when you're playing in front of a home crowd, even on a punch that barely grazes a guy, the crowd goes wild because most can't
exactly.
quite see it up close.
Exactly. Vantage point is huge when you're scoring a fight or of course, if you're in your hometown where you have a lot of, you know, sentimental love and all that stuff, rightfully so. And also, to Jose's credit, there's a lot more pressure because you have all these people. You know, and that's subconsciously that's in your back of your mind. But I will say this, for people who criticized it, I thought it was a great win, if not one of his greatest wins. Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna tell you why. Not so much the opponent, but the other opponent in the ring. It was Freddie Roach, who spent 85% of Jose's professional career as his trainer. Now he's on the opposing side. He knows where all the bodies are buried.
It's like when a coordinator in football suddenly is on your rival,
right.
And they're saying, here's what he's going to do.
And they yell out your plays.
Yes.
You don't flip over your playbook. Everyone thinks that in the NFL. That's when everyone's like, Tony Romo calls the plays. I'm like, everybody knows everybody's plays.
Yeah.
They just show different looks. That's not rocket science.
Yeah.
but in boxing, if you could see, first of all, Zepeda was a lefty. He did what lefties should do. He said the outside foot. He got off first. He made Jose react. Jose is used to being setting things up with his jab. He's very technical. He's extremely well-coached technical fighter, Jose is. Jose Ramirez. Zepeda knew the plan. He knew the rhythm. If you notice, he would catch, grab, spin, move, touch, late hit, hits in the ear, hits in the head.
He knew how to cut off the momentum every single time.
Yes, because when Jose plants his feet and digs in and sets you up with the jab, left hook to the body, left hook to the head, usually it's lights out. They took that away for the most part.
And let me jump right in here because this is great. There was something that I noticed that I've not seen anybody do. I don't know if this is something that's indigenous to a southpaw, but what Zepeda kept doing a lot was he would get into this almost crouched position. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's to take something away or if he was trying to bait Jose Ramirez into making a mistake by a certain punch he was trying to will him into. But you know what I'm talking about. And he would crouch down there. Was that by design?
I think what he was doing was he was taking away the body shots. And he knew
with the left.
Yeah. And he knew Jose was headhunting. Jose was very aggressive. He was going for the knockout. You could see it. He was very aggressive. But when Jose is effective is when it's an accumulation of punches and he breaks you down technically. That's when he's most effective. So I think that he had a lot of stress on his mind. I didn't talk to him about it, but I'm guessing that was in the back of his mind, the Freddie Roach thing, and these guys know some tricks. So he had a lot to overcome. That's why I think I had it tied going into the ninth round, at the end of the ninth round, and I thought he won the fight. I agree with the card, 115-113. And I thought it was going to be, just knowing judging, I thought it was going to be a split decision Jose's way. He clearly won the last round. He went and got it. He dug deep. He had to overcome a cut from a headbutt. It was an accidental, but they've clashed heads probably four or five times in that fight. And you have that when you have a southpaw against a traditional orthodox fighter. That happens a lot when they're both aggressive.
And it's so that really speaks to what I wanted to ask you next, and that is that, again, and I've said this a couple of times leading up to this segment, these segments with you today, Coach, and that is that I'm not some knowledgeable boxing scoring guy. Mm-hmm. But my sense, though, when we got to the 10th was, Jose's going to have to pick this up a little bit because my sense was it was really close. Was that kind of how you had it?
I felt the same way. I was sitting next to Ellie Setback, who's at every fight, a lot of other people that are very knowledgeable. And, of course, my heart is always with Jose, but covering it in just on a professional level, I said he's got to go to work just to make sure this is solid. And that's why I give him credit to say for what he overcame, I thought it was one of his greatest wins. I know people might say, oh, he was busted up. He had a cut. He was bleeding. It was close. These are the fights that make you great.
Yeah.
When you can overcome these things and these type of roadblocks and these type of difficulties. These are give you the character to make you great. So I look forward to seeing him at his next fight, which from here on in, folks, I hate to tell you, there are no easy fights. They're all going to be wars. He's a world champion.
Well, did you... the sense that the ESPN guys were saying, and I mean, I wanted to be there so badly, but I had something else I had to be at, so I was dialed in and with my popcorn and beverage watching it on the TV. But it did look that this was by design that Jose Ramirez looked like he was really feeling out where Zepeda was at, what Zepeda was trying to do. He wasn't going for some 15-second knockout. He was measuring him.
The first four rounds, you could tell he was trying to figure out how are they going to come. It was a chess match. And you heard some of the crowd, woo, woo. No. This is for a world championship. This is for all the marbles. They were both being very cautious in the first two rounds. Zepeda was very athletic, fast feet. Slippery, would like I said, hold, grab, spin, move, turn you, frustrate you, trying to make sure Jose didn't catch rhythm because he's a rhythm fighter. He's like a rhythm shooter. I think of Jose as like a J.J. Redick. Mm. Once they get hot, you're doomed. You could throw two people at him, three people at him. Once he starts getting those combos off and he's comfortable and he moves side to side, you'll see him dip his head, come up. His defense, he slips a lot of punches, but this guy knew tricks. So that means Freddie had a great game plan. So that's why I give Jose Ramirez credit for overcoming all those things.
What is we're talking with Coach Pete Lopes. He is one of the really great boxing minds that I've ever met, and certainly one of the best in the Central Valley. We're talking about last night's Zepeda-Ramirez fight, Jose Ramirez winning on a majority decision, 116, 112, 115, 113, and then one judge, Renata Danseco, 114, 114. Tell me about, from the boxer's mentality, and I mean Jose Ramirez, mm-hmm. where frustration can sometimes, it doesn't happen with him, but frustration can get the best of a boxer, and when he starts to try to follow me for a moment. In theater, you always say you should let the script play you. Don't play the script.
Exactly.
In boxing, you have to do the same thing, and if you get away from your script, is it possible that you're going to get frustrated, leave yourself open, and suddenly a guy that would have no business knocking you out cracks you with a good one?
You hit the nail on the head. The master of following the game plan is Floyd Mayweather. He knows he's slower now. He knows he doesn't punch as hard anymore. Over the last, let's say, the last 5 years of his career, he would admit that. But he knows if I stick to the game plan, you will make a mistake, and I will capitalize on that mistake. That's what the trainers are so important, because they, when you have two elite fighters where there's not much gap in skills, that's those little things. It's like when we watch the Super Bowl, somebody makes a mistake, and then the whole game changes.
Right.
Like one little thing. And the boxing matches at the elite championship level are very much like that. They're evenly matched. Somebody's going to make a mistake, and then everything goes crazy.
Because it seemed like I kept getting this idea, and maybe the imagery here is Jose Ramirez was a spring, and it just kept getting wound tighter and tighter. And when he would get an opening and the flurry of punches that he would throw, three, four, five in a row, they were lightning fast. He maybe didn't score with all of them, but he would score enough.
Yes.
And I kept waiting for him to put down Zepeda once and for all. And when it didn't happen, to Zepeda's credit,
right.
It just kept going forward. But gosh. It shows what remarkable conditioning Ramirez has, because Ramirez seemed, at least on television, like he was towering over Zepeda. It may not have been that way, but I kept waiting for him to just swat him away and be done with him. And that has to, at some point, mentally weigh on you, that even more what you just said, Coach, that you have to just keep telling yourself in your corner, Robert Garcia's telling him, you got
to
just stay focused and stay the course.
Stick to the plan, and that's what you saw. And that's why I looked at it without emotion to say, listen, this guy is making the adjustments he needs to retain his title. And that's what I feel like he did. He did it in the last two rounds. He figured it out. But to Zepeda's credit, they had a great game plan.
And both immensely classy after the fight.
Oh, sharp.
No surprise at all.
No. Classy guys, high level athletes. And Jose's the same way. You know, he doesn't talk trash.
Never.
Or
I love that about him.
He won't even play around like that. So I thoroughly enjoyed the fight. And I think this is what will make Jose great. This will be a legendary fight for him, because he had to overcome some things. And it wasn't necessarily the opponent. No disrespect to the opponent, but there was another elephant in the room.
It's a lot like what you're saying. It's a lot like the basketball team that is, I'm going to say college team, that is beating everybody by 20 to 30, and then they get into a nail biter where it's going down to the wire. It's a 1-point game, and they have to learn how to win a game that way.
Exactly.
Let's do one more segment, and I want to talk about Jose going forward, because these fights in Fresno ultimately are not going to continue.
No.
Sooner or later, they're going to go elsewhere. I want to talk about him going up to yet another level. We know what the ceiling is. There is no ceiling with Jose Ramirez. We're talking with our good friend Coach Pete Lopes, Mr. Savvy Boxing Elite Mind. I'm so glad that we were able to get him to come in this afternoon. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
We're talking about the aftermath of last night's majority decision. Jose Ramirez defeats Jose Zepeda, 116, 112, 115, 113, 114, 114. Is it a fair statement to say that when you are a boxer and you are the challenger and you are playing the game, so to speak, in the champion's home turf, that you have to do that much more to get some love and to win any kind of majority or a decision.
No doubt about it. I mean, I wish that wasn't so, but it is what it is. That's the spirit.
Yeah, right.
You've got to really spank the champion to take his belt.
Almost a knockout. I mean,
Or really, I mean, beat him up.
Yeah.
Like if he had wobbled Jose in the 11th and the 12th, maybe he would have had a chance at taking that decision. But I mean, I honestly don't think Jose's that type of fighter. I don't think anyone's ever gonna beat him up. I don't think
he just seems too elusive.
Yeah, he's not gonna do that. He's not gonna give you that.
Yeah.
I think one day he may meet somebody and the matchup is off and he gets beat, but he's not gonna get beat up. He's not gonna come unprepared. He's not gonna come sloppy. He's not gonna make that mistake. I've always said his biggest asset is his mind. And when I say that, I say he's like a sponge. If you put Jose in a gym with elite people and he's the younger guy and the older guy, he's going to suck up the game. He's going to soak it up.
Well, you know, that's a great point, because as I watched Jose, and I'm watching the fight differently than you. I don't have the expertise and knowledge you have, but I've seen enough to know that what I saw him doing in the way he was so measured in the first 3, 4, 5 rounds, he was starting to expose things on Zepeda that he wasn't in the first 3 or 4 rounds. And it's clear that he processed that. His onboard computer, his brain, was processing that, as was Robert Garcia.
And you could see he would feint, he would throw the straight right, left hook, and he didn't get greedy. The times when he tried to stay in the pocket, he got countered. But when he just took the 1-2, the feint and the hard right and the left hook, those landed. He was catching Zepeda with clean right hands. And I'd like to see him throw more right hands. Early in his career, he had a nasty 1-2. He'd set you up with the jab, double jab, and throw the straight right. Then he really went left hook crazy, left hook to the body, because it worked. He was getting people out of there with body shots. But you're going to run into guys at 140. And then if he does decide to venture, there's whispers that they may venture into 147. Those bodies are different, and they're built a little different.
Yeah.
So those body punches are going to have to be an accumulation of punches, not going to be one shot.
If he goes up in weight, how difficult is it to retain his speed and quickness as he puts on more muscle?
He's long he's pretty tall for a 140 and a 147 guy. He's pretty tall, so I think he'll be fine. Shout out to his strength guy, Charles Tremley. He's pretty innovative. He's smart. He's always learning and always trying to get better. They'll figure that out. He's a lanky guy, so he's going to have good whip on his punches. I think he'll be fine. Most people don't get stronger as they go up in weight. There's been a few, and we know what that's all about. But most people don't. But I think he would have a good time because he's long and rangy. He'd be fine at 147.
Okay.
And he may be... He may have a little bit more oomph in his step because they'll put on some a mass in his legs and in his rump.
I got a kick out of Rick Merigian when he was walking out. Rick had the game face on, too. They all had the game face.
At all times.
They all had the game. I love that. They all come out. They all got the look. Last thing for you. We've got a couple minutes left. As Jose continues to expand his boxing profile as the world champion, whether he goes up in weight or not, the fights in Fresno are not going to continue forever. It's just unlikely because there's Las Vegas is calling, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I don't know the ins and outs. I just know, like I said, on my side where I'm at the PBC, when you get into title fights, you're going to start getting in. Like, let's say the ticket to get into the same market, the cheapest ticket was like $22. Okay. Now, you've been to fights in Vegas.
Yep.
You've been to fights in Vegas. You can't get in the building for $22.
You can't. Good luck getting a beer.
So for these guys to get their purses, this money has to come from somewhere.
Right.
So eventually, if you get a unification bout, and Jose's going to say, I want $1.5 million, let's say, and the opponent's going to say, well, I want that, or I ain't coming. That's three right there. And now with the networks and TV, things can get done. But that the promoters aren't in this business to take L's and lose money.
That's
and
right.
Lose revenue. So that money has to probably come from a casino or a major sponsor. You never know. One of these rich farmers may want to put up. They said for the Mayweather Pacquiao fight, Bob Arum said at one time there was an oil sheik that offered an ungodly amount of money just to make the fight happen when they weren't sure it was going to happen. And they said, what was the fee? And he said, it's so big that I'm embarrassed to even say what it is. He just wanted to see it.
Yeah.
And he was like, do you want us to come to, like, Dubai? He was like, no, just do it in Vegas. I just want to see it. I'll put up the money. So you never know with boxing. You never know what happens.
Is there a chance, I mean, just speculate for me, that instead of a Vegas, that Jose could go to a place like a Staples Center or something like that?
Definitely. Or, I know this would be something, maybe he fights for unification at Bulldog Stadium.
Wouldn't that be cool?
And you can make the revenue because you got 60,000 seats if you add it all up.
So sort of another version of Thrill in Manila.
Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be awesome. It's also awesome when we have you, my man. It's just great to have you.
I appreciate you.
Yes, indeed. He is Pete Lopes and one of the great elite minds when it comes to boxing in this area. You have to come back and visit us again, my friend.
Whenever you need me.
All right, brother. Coming up, hour number three, and in hour number three, besides top five at five, we're going to have Tom Van Herren. We're talking college football recruiting, the mysterious land known as the transfer portal, and much more. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
The Top 5 at 5 is sponsored by the Law Office of Josh Lazar and Associates. And now, from Fresno, California, to the furthest reaches of the galaxy, here are your Top 5 at 5 sports talkers of the day.
Top 5 at 5 for a Monday. Good stuff today, man. Good stuff. Good to have Pete Lopes break down the fight for us. That was great. Cam Morrell talking about the Alliance. And Tony D, of course, Mr. Reliable. And then bottom of the hour, we'll talk with Tom Van Herren from ESPN. We'll talk a little transfer portal, talk about National Signing Day versus the early signing period. And a lot of the coaches around the country, going back to the transfer portal, very concerned about giving players latitude to make the moves that they're making. I'm all in favor of it. I think the concern over, and I'll mention this to Tom, see what he thinks, this idea that you're going to have, you know, 70-80% of college football players going all over the country to different programs, I think that's unfounded. But we'll see what he thinks. All right, we'll see. Look, take a look at our stories today and see how many of these you might have already heard. Maybe one of these. I think that's about it. Let's begin.
Number one.
Well, how'd you like to be Nick Stauskas? You know, when he came into the league, he was drafted by, I believe it was Sacramento, but he was the number 8 overall pick in 2014. And he was thought to be, he's going to be a great player. He's absolutely going to be a great player. It hasn't quite worked out that way. He was a reserve for the Portland Trail Blazers this year. He was averaging just over 6 points a game and a couple of rebounds a game and about an assist and a half. That was for 44. That was in 44 games for the Trailblazers as a reserve. Well, last week, inside of 1 week, he was traded 3 times. He was traded 3 times. Think about if your job had the ability to trade you to another office, and whatever company it was, you started in Fresno, and then in the course of 1 week, you went Fresno to Denver. Oops, no, and then you go Denver to Salt Lake City, and then, no, that's not your landing point. You're going to go Salt Lake City to Cleveland. Well, Cleveland is where he ended up, but the deal is this. He was sent to Cleveland. He was briefly with the Cavs. They got him from the Portland Trail Blazers, and then he didn't appear in any games for Cleveland. A couple of days later, he goes to the Houston Rockets. Houston Rockets, yeah. Didn't do anything with the Rockets. And then they traded him just before the deadline, to the Indiana Pacers. The Pacers then waived him. So he's going Portland to Cleveland to Houston to Indiana. He gets waived after all that. This is all inside of a week. And then who do you think scoops him up? Well, it's the Cleveland Cavaliers. So, that's just crazy. That's just crazy. And I guess you're happy to have a job, right? You're making a lot of money. You're not making you'll never make the kind of money. Nick Stauskas is never going to make the kind of money that a LeBron, a Kevin Durant, a Steph Curry, or any of them. But you're making good money. But I mean, he's also played for Brooklyn and Philadelphia as well as Sacramento, the team that drafted him. So I guess that's probably the definition of journeyman player. And you think about the amount of teams that he's either played for or been a part of, even for a couple of hours or a couple of days. We're talking 6-7 teams inside of 5 seasons. That's, wow. Yeah, you hope for a guy to catch on, but then, again, you realize he's making a lot of money, he's living his dream, and he's on a certain level, he's probably just fine with all of it.
Number 2.
Well, Russ's guy, Madison Bumgarner, did you hear his comments today? Yeah. He's made his views very clear on this whole opener movement, you know, where you have somebody kind of open a game up for a couple of batters, an inning. The idea being, by and large, to save your starter, to not have him, you know, get taxed too much. We saw that last year in the regular season. We saw it in the playoffs as well. Well, Saturday was Fan Fest for the Giants. These are always fun. Every team does these. I think every team does it. Most. We'll just say most, because I can't confirm that every team does it. But they have these Fan Fests, Winter Fests, whatever you want to call them, where the players show up and they take pictures and some autographs. And it's a general fun get-together. And some players really, really relish doing that and meeting the fans. And then others are a little standoffish, and so be it. But you had the president of baseball operations, Farhan, is it Zaidi? Okay, that's close enough. I try very hard to get these names right, so bear with me. But saying that, Bruce Bochy had mentioned that he had received a text from Madison Bumgarner expressing his views about whether or not he'd be okay with the whole opener situation. And Bumgarner said the following after Zaidi said that the Giants might use, and if I'm pronouncing that name wrong, I apologize, but this is what Bumgarner said in the text, and I'm quoting directly. If you use an opener in my game, I'm walking right out of the ballpark. That's pretty clear, don't you think? That's reasonably clear. I cannot imagine Madison Bumgarner scheduled a pitch and not having him on the mound in the first inning. I just can't see it. Just can't see it at all. This is not somebody who is some average or mediocre starter. I mean, this is a guy who is averaging, you know, close to 7 innings a start. And that's going back to his first season in the starting rotation going back to 2011. So that's pretty good. You know, this is a guy who's not gone over 3.37 in his career in terms of ERA. You're a Giants fan. You're a big Giants fan. Can he still be, is a kind of a yes or no, can he still be as effective as he was, say, 3-4 years ago? Yeah. I think so, too. And, I mean, obviously they need him. I mean, they need him to have a great year. But I love when guys say, yeah, that might be your plan. That might be what you want to do. But here's the deal. And you wonder Bochy loves Bumgarner, but if you had any kind of an acrimonious relationship, you just wonder, you're going to challenge me? You're going to walk out? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to have an opener. We'll see what you do. And I wonder, Bumgarner seems the kind of guy that would do it, that he would say, I'm out of here, and he would leave. You think he would? Okay. I mean, joking or not, I think there are players that would do that. I think back to the days of Steve Carlton when he was with the Phillies, and Carlton basically didn't talk to his own teammates, much less talk to the media. Back in the days of Dallas Green as his manager and then Larry Boa as a teammate, and I just think about a guy like him. Like, if he had said that, he's walking out. And he's not only going to walk out, he's going to do it across the outfield. He's going to make sure that you see him as he's walking out.
Number 3.
Well, the Miami Marlins, they want you, Marlins fans, to give them a chance. Michael Hill is the president of baseball operations. Now I want to see somebody put somebody in front of Madison Bumgarner. I want to see something go on. The Marlins are saying, their president is saying, you got to give us a chance. And he said that, literally. I want to tell our fans just to give us a chance. So many people have written off the Marlins, I can't imagine why, and really haven't taken an opportunity to take a deep look at what we're building. When you have a lot to do, it's going to take time, and we understand where we're at, but we've been able to add a tremendous amount of talent over the last 18 months. Okay, so the Marlins won 63 games last year. Last year was their ninth consecutive year playing baseball under 500. And it is the 15th, it was, I should say, the 15th consecutive year that they missed the postseason. The only team that's missed it longer or had a longer drought in baseball is Seattle. They've missed it 17 straight years. Their attendance, they didn't even draw a million fans. 811,104. And Dan Straley, pitcher on their staff, said, well, only one team gets to win the championship every year. That's true. That's true. But when you look at what Derek Jeter did and the Giancarlo Stanton deal and, you know, just letting him go, essentially, that's essentially what he did. I don't know when the Marlins year is coming. It's not going to be this year. It's probably not going to be next year. It might not be for 3 or 4 years. And if I'm a fan of that team, I'm looking at the management. I'm looking at ownership and management and wondering what direction are we going? Yeah, you've brought some prospects. You've brought some upper-level players into the organization. We get that. But, you know, you've restocked the farm system. Most experts agree. You hear people like Jason Stark. I haven't heard from Mike Oz on this yet, but you hear people like Jason Stark saying, Tim Kirkjian saying that they've definitely done a better job of, you know, retooling their farm system. But you just go back to what Jeter did and it just looked like he was cleaning house there, and that's essentially what they did. And of course nobody's showing up. And they may want the fans, you know, they're asking the fans for patience, give them a chance. But these days, especially in South Florida, where rent is high, going to sporting events is high, whether you're going to see you know, any of the professional teams there, or you're going to see the Miami Hurricanes, or you're going out to dinner, you're going to anything there, it's not cheap. And it is a hard ask for fans to say, bear with us, give us a chance, we want to see you at the ballpark. Their tickets aren't the most expensive in baseball. They're certainly not cheap, though. And you got to give reasons, give fans a reason or reasons to come and show up and to spend their money on a team that has missed the playoffs for 15 straight years.
Number four.
This story really surprised me. I shouldn't say story, but the audio, hearing Magic Johnson saying that the New Orleans Pelicans didn't act in good faith. He came out, this is after the Lakers got blasted by the Sixers in Philly, 140-123, saying the following. We knew that basically, at the end of the day, what happened, happened. And we knew that when we first started in terms of what happened. But, hey, it is what it is. I'm just not buying that. Essentially saying that we kind of knew this was the way it was going to be. Well, no, because you can't have it that way and then say that they didn't act in good faith. It's one thing when Magic Johnson or any GM is negotiating with a player's agent and you think you've got something working and you're spending days, if not a week or two or three, working out a new contract. And then at the end, you know, if the player's a free agent, you're trying to do it. And then suddenly they just bolt on you. This was not that situation. The New Orleans Pelicans didn't owe the Lakers anything in the way of acting in good faith. The Lakers were bidding against themselves. And all you were getting was the Pelicans just not saying anything. And now you have the Lakers coming out and saying, well, all these packages that you were seeing reported were just never true. Well, that's convenient to say after the fact. But, you know, I do agree with Magic on this point, saying quit making this, talking about the whole situation with the players and talking about young players that might have been moved in this deal had it happen. Quit making this about thinking these guys are babies, because that's what you're treating them like. They're professionals, all of them, and this is how this league works. They know it, I know it, that's how it goes. He's right about that. He's absolutely right about that. You're there one day, you're gone the next, and maybe you're Stauskas, and you're gone three times in 1 week. So, you know, these guys who are making big salaries, they're you know, playing basketball at the highest level in the world, and, yeah, he's right about that. But he also went on to say all deals are, well, a lot of them are made in public. We didn't make it in public, but that's part of it. That's what happens, man. We got big boys here, and they bounce back. They're fine. But you have to wonder at some point. You know, it didn't work out with Anthony Davis. It didn't work out with Paul George. It didn't work out with Kawhi Leonard. And I don't know what they're going to do this summer. They're going to get somebody. They're going to get somebody on this team. But you do start to wonder. You do have to put some level of credence into what other players have come out and said, put their names on comments and saying that there's a certain reluctance, by a number of the upper echelon players in the league to want to play with LeBron. Why that is? You know, you're going to lose your identity. You're servicing his legacy. Well, players wanted to play with Michael Jordan. Players wanted to play with Larry Bird. I realize there's different eras, the 90s, the 80s. I get it. But, I mean, this is the third guy they've missed on. And they've, you know, they've not been able to, in the case of Kawhi and Anthony Davis, you know, you're talking about trades. Can't blame a team for not wanting to trade with the Lakers. With Paul George, different story. They figured they're going to bring him home, free agent, it's going to work out. Didn't work out. I can't wait till July gets here.
Number five.
Boy, when Bob Stoops, 3 weeks before the Oklahoma Sooners season came to pass, back in June, it was June in 2017 when Stoops said, I'm done. I'm handing over the reins to Lincoln Riley. I didn't think that was going to be the case. I thought a year or two later he would end up in another college job. I don't know if it was going to be Notre Dame, or maybe he was going to go back and take over Florida. But I figured he'd end up somewhere. What I didn't figure on is that he was going to end up in the XFL. But that is where he is returning to football. He's going to be the head coach and the general manager of the Dallas franchise in the XFL. Stoops said, at first I thought it probably wouldn't be for me. But through our discussions as a family, started to think this would fit us correctly. I was also excited about starting something from the ground floor to hiring coaches, and then you got to accumulate your players, get your organization set up. It reminds me of when I first arrived at Oklahoma. I thought one of the best things I ever did in my career was getting my first staff together at OU. That's exciting to me, the opportunity to put it together and help it grow. And again, the XFL, you know, the Alliance started this year, and you've got their championship game is going to be April 27th. We mentioned that earlier at Sam Boyd Stadium in Las Vegas. What do you think draws more? Does the Alliance Championship draw more or less than the near sellout that the Las Vegas Bowl drew with Arizona State and Fresno State? Because there weren't a lot of empty seats in that stadium, you know. And this would be interesting. It'd be interesting to see that. I'm going to guess that I'm not going to be covering that unless the station wants to send us all there. Then you just never know. We'll do that. But Globe Life Park. That's where the Rangers play. And that's going to be reconfigured for the Dallas XFL team. And I Cam and I talked about this a little bit earlier. I don't think it's really any mystery that between the Alliance of American Football, the XFL, and I don't remember what that other league is, but there is a number of ex-players that are starting this other spring league. So ultimately, you're going to have three of these leagues. I think one will probably survive. You know, the USFL, you had the World Football League for a while. That went away. You had the European deal. USFL, I remember seeing games back in old Giant Stadium when Herschel Walker had just come out of Georgia. And it was pretty cool to see him, you know, the runner that you saw at Georgia. And, I mean, he was just unstoppable as a Georgia Bulldog. To see him in his absolute prime, yeah, it was the USFL. But just to watch him was pretty amazing. And then, you know, the rest of the time, then the USFL went away. They made a lot of bad decisions for a lot of different reasons and a lot of different people involved. But it'll be interesting. I think with Charlie Ebersole and the people that they have in play for this league, because I looked it up a little bit earlier. I mean, you've got some pretty big names with this league, with the Alliance. Charlie Ebersol, Bill Polian, Troy Polamalu, J.K. McKay from the McKay family, Hines Ward, Jared Allen. You know, board of directors, Dick Ebersol's on there. I mean, you know, you got some pretty decent names. Coaches, I mean, the coaches, almost every one of them you know. Mike Martz, Mike Riley, Dennis Erickson, Rick Neuheisel, Spurrier, Mike Singletary, Tim Lewis, Kevin Coyle. Kevin Coyle I'm not as familiar with. Doesn't ring a bell like Steve Spurrier or Rick Neuheisel or anybody, but it'll be interesting. So there you go. Bob Stoops returning to coaching in the XFL. What is the XFL going to do that's going to try to improve upon things that they believe that Vince McMahon and his crew believe the NFL misses, and what are they going to try to improve upon that the Alliance has already shown us that they're doing? That's going to be interesting to see two spring leagues or late winter going into spring leagues and how that's going to all work out, and if McMahon is going to go the WWE route of trying to, you know, bluster and get bombastic and really throw stuff out there, trying to lure Charlie Ebersol into that thing. Might we end up seeing Charlie Ebersol and Vince McMahon in an octagon? That screams Rick Morigian promotion. Just, it really does. Top 5 and 5.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Potential upset looming, college basketball tonight. Number 4, Virginia, is out in Chapel Hill. They are down to the Tar Heels right now. Tar Heels ranked 8th. Those rankings are the Associated Press. They are down 7 right now. If you've watched Virginia, now they're down 5. If you've watched Virginia play, well, it's just not my style of basketball. Yeah, I know they play a clamp-it-down defensive style. I get that. They're great at the defensive end, but I'm just not a fan of this 1950s walk it up court. Hank Iba used to play this style where let's have 7 to 10 to 12 passes, work it around, maybe run a little weave, and I don't know what the point is. I give me an offense, give me a college offense like Justin Hudson's, where, you know, you're running your play, what have you, but if somebody has an open lane to the basket, he takes it. If somebody, as you're in the middle of running a play, suddenly finds himself wide open from 18, 20, 21 feet, take the shot. Give your players the freedom to do that versus trying to be in the 50s and keep a game low because that's the way you want to play it. I get it. Virginia's successful, but I think if Virginia gets into a game where they're down 10 or 12, well, UMBC exposed them last year. In the first round, UMBC came out and they were draining threes all over the court. They were running, gunning, but it was controlled run and gun. And they just kept building the lead, and Virginia had absolutely, they had not played anybody that played that style so effectively. I'm not saying UMBC last year in that first round, that number 1 versus number 16 matchup, in which finally a number 1 seed goes down in the first round. But UMBC didn't have more talent than Virginia did. They didn't have more talent than 60 of the teams ahead of them. But they played a style that night that was superb. They were flawless at it, and Virginia didn't know how to respond. They couldn't respond because the style they play doesn't allow it. It's like the rare times back in the Tom Osborne days when Nebraska, they usually beat the heck out of everybody, but on those rare moments when they got way behind a Barry Switzer Oklahoma team or some other team, they were not geared up. They were not put together to come back from 2 touchdowns down, from 17 points down. It didn't happen often, but when they were down, they stayed down. So that, to me, is the pitfall of a team like the Virginia Cavaliers. All right, coming up, our good friend from ESPN, Tom Van Herren. Tom is great when you talk about college football recruiting. He is one of the guys there that is all over it. We've had him on the program several times before. Lots to talk about the transfer portal, National Signing Day, early signing period, and more. Maybe even cake, because he'd like to talk about cake if you could just give up everything else. Tom Van Herren is next. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
You always hear me whining about weather here because I'm a Midwesterner, so I like snow. I don't like 25 below, but pulled in here into our building the other day, and one of the cars in the parking lot had probably 2 or 3 inches of snow on top because he came from Coors Gold, which, as all of you know, is not far from the south gate of Yosemite, and he had told us that he got 10 inches of snow the night before. I just one night in Fresno. Can we get a little snow? Can we just anything? I'd be okay with that. I won't be able to sell that to friends back in the Midwest or to friends back in the Northeast who have had quite enough of winter. There's no doubt about that. One of those friends is Tom Van Herren, and we love having Tom on the program. It's been too long since we've had Tom on the program, but Tom works for ESPN, and he is all over college football and recruiting and cake. And we bring Tom Van Herren on right now. How are you, Tom?
I'm doing well. I was going to throw this out there. If you want to switch with me, I'll happily move out to Fresno, and you can come to cold, blizzardy Michigan if you want. Just if you want.
Oh, is it, now, you're in Michigan. I didn't know you were in Michigan. I have some friends in Detroit and in Chelsea, actually. And, yes, they share your view that they don't want to hear me talking about weather when they look and they see it's 57 here, and then I complain, Tom, that there's a chill in the air, and then the phone gets disconnected, and that's that.
Yeah, this is about the time in Michigan where everybody gets to an anger level because we haven't been outside for about 4 months. So we're all, if you come to Michigan, if you're visiting here and everybody's a little bit feisty, that's cut them some slack. We've been inside for 4 months.
Listen, I can relate so well, Tom, as I've mentioned to you before. I spent 6 years in Fargo. And, yeah, it's just, you know, the underground tunnel is getting an idea there. The people want to start building those. So, Tom and Adam Rittenberg, another friend of ours who comes on the program a lot, Tom and Adam wrote a great piece together called Portals, Waivers, and the Future of College Football Free Agency. Interesting term to juxtapose with college football. We'll get to that in a moment. This is a subject, Tom, that we talk about on this program a lot. We're the flagship for Fresno State, so this is right in our wheelhouse. I'll get right to this part of it. I've just never believed that broadening the ability for players to transfer, relaxing the rules, giving them a little bit more latitude and freedom would result in what many are calling free agency. Because you and I both know with transferring, you're learning a new system, you're getting acclimated to new surroundings, you're making new friends, there's a new social climate. It's not as easy as an adjustment as many want to believe. That said, so is what you're hearing a major concern from coaches, that there's going to be just this huge upheaval of players wanting to go all over the country to different programs?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of the coaches that Adam and I talked to for this article are concerned with the way that everything is starting to go, because these rules are new. And so everybody's kind of feeling everything out, where this transfer portal is new. There's the redshirt rule that we saw Kelly Bryant use to his advantage and take advantage of the four-game rule with redshirting and then transferring. And I think coaches, now that the season is over with, they're really seeing what the effects are of the transfer portal, where we talked to one coach and we talked to the NCAA who said there's over 1,000 kids in the transfer portal. Now, that's over quite a few different divisions, but there's a lot of kids in that portal. And I think the concern for on the coach's end is that if the NCAA allows these players just to enter the portal and then they're given a waiver to be eligible immediately the next season, there are no repercussions for the players to transfer, and they'll be able to just move from school to school as they please. And ultimately it's going to affect how they manage their roster and how they build their teams. And I think a big part of that nobody's really discussing right now is, and I'm going to try to make this real simple because a lot of this can get really complicated.
Sure.
But essentially, in recruiting, coaches are able to sign 25 initial counters, which are scholarship athletes. Now, that's not just high school football players; that's junior college players, and transfers are included in that as well. So the thought from the coaches is, with the early signing period added in now, if you lose 20 guys to graduation and then you lose 20 guys or 15 guys to transfer, that's 35 scholarships that you're losing, but you can only sign 25. So that's 10 scholarships that coaches would not be able to make up in that given year. And that's really a lot of where the concern comes from. You know, we talked to the NCAA and a few other people about the waiver process and gaining eligibility immediately. And what we found from the NCAA was since last year, 64 FBS players applied for immediate eligibility waivers and 51 received approvals. And I think that's a big concern as well for a lot of coaches, that 79% of players applying for waivers to be eligible immediately were granted. And I think their perception is that it should be the other way around.
So, and part of that is the phrase mitigating circumstances. And how does the NCAA define that? Is it loosely defined? Is that something that coaches would like reeled in and narrowed a bit?
Yeah, that's a big part of the problem, I think, with this is there's no hard rule on what mitigating circumstances are or what qualifies to get you approved for a waiver, what the criteria is or what the circumstance is. Nobody really knows what that definition is or how that's defined, and so you go into a situation and I think Justin Fields is kind of sparking a lot of this conversation. Who the quarterback who transferred from Georgia to Ohio State, he was just granted his waiver to be eligible immediately next season, and of course Tate Martell, the quarterback who transferred from Ohio State to Miami, is waiting on his waiver request as well. But I think that's a big part of it for coaches, is that if they have a player who goes into the transfer portal or who even expresses interest in transferring, they really don't have a selling point for that player to say, hey, you know, you're going to have to go sit out a year. You're going to have to go learn a new system. You're going to have to be in a new environment. They don't really know if that's going to be the case. The player, judging by the factors and the numbers that we have, as I mentioned, 79% of players that are requesting a waiver are getting it. The player, I think now as we move forward in this, I think they're going into it thinking, I have a good shot at playing next year and playing right away, so why not test the waters and why not transfer? And I think that's a big concern for a lot of the coaches.
My guest is Tom Van Herren. He's with ESPN, of course, deals with a lot of college football recruiting. His work is great. You see him on television. You see his work on ESPN.com. I want to take that a step further because you entered into this great piece. You brought Travis Leach in. He's an attorney. Assisting that the waiver campaign with Tate Martell, and he insists that that if an athlete feels, and this is right from what you wrote, negatively affected by his original school, quote, this is coming from Travis Leach, it should really be the burden of someone else to disprove that. All right, that's one box. Another box that's in this is what Gary Patterson from TCU said, talking about players wanting to leave, going through the transfer portal, and he said it can't just be because you don't like somebody or somebody said something to you. We all have to live in a world that's like that. So I get what Coach Patterson is saying, Tom, that if your feelings are hurt or you don't like this or that, you just can't up and leave. But I think, isn't that trying to put too neat of a bow on it? Because a lot of times players do have, and it might not be health, it might not be a family member, but they do have legitimate reasons for wanting to depart a school, whether it's the social climate, whether the environment of the program itself, whatever the case may be, was something that just didn't mesh with what he thought it was going to be, and he wants to leave. Shouldn't there be that avenue to do so? And the player should have as much latitude, or at least close to as much, as a coach has.
Yeah, I think so. And my belief is that the player should be allowed to move around, and if they're unhappy, and if it's not the right situation for them, I think they should. There should be guidelines, but I do think they should be able to do that. And it was interesting for me because we spoke to some of the players who are going through the transfer process right now or who have transferred. Juwan Johnson from Penn State, Cameron Rising, a quarterback from Texas, and Asa Martin, a running back who's transferring from Auburn. And Asa Martin and Juwan Johnson, that was really the main sentiment from them was, you know, they both said, my dream is to make it to the NFL, and I've only got 3, 4, or 5 years to prove that I can do it or show what I can do. If I'm not in a situation that I feel comfortable in, if I'm not in a situation that I think I can achieve my dream and my goal, then why should I not be able to go somewhere where I think I can achieve that? And that was the main message, I think, from a lot of players. And that really, that was the voice that we haven't heard in a lot of these stories, was from the players themselves that are going through it. And I found it pretty interesting, their perspective. Cameron Rising was actually pretty honest and forthright about the waiver process, that he said he thinks that players should be able to transfer. He said the transfer portal was outstanding. It was so easy to use. It made his process really, really easy. But he said that he does side with coaches in terms of, if you do transfer, you should have a legitimate reason to play right away the next season. That if you don't have a legitimate reason, then you should have to sit out a year. So, you know, there's this back and forth with all this stuff. The players think they should be eligible. Some don't think they should be eligible right away. The coaches think that there should be some penalty. And I think the main factor that I took away from this, or the main message that I took away from this from both sides, was no matter the solution that you come up with, you're never going to have both sides come together and say, we're happy, this is good. With this situation, you're never going to make both sides happy. And I think that's what we have to look at with this, is what does the most good for the NCAA, for the student athlete, and for the coaches, because there is no one solution that's going to make everybody happy and everybody say, okay, this is great for everybody.
That's very well said. And one more thought about this before we talk about early signing day, early signing period, and versus the national signing day. Listen, as somebody who went through recruiting, but for basketball, there was, going back to when I played, there's always been, and you know this, Tom, the NCAA is always counseling, and it's written up on websites and what have you, that you're signing, you're committing to a school, you're not committing to a coach. But the issue that I have with that, maybe issue is too strong of a word, is that college, unlike professional in any sport, college is driven by coaches. And to suggest that a player, a five-star, a four-star, any star, is committing to Alabama because they're interested in the business school at Alabama versus playing for Nick Saban is ridiculous. And I it's commendable that the NCAA impresses that upon players, but I feel like that's a little bit swimming upstream to try to get players to understand that. Would you agree?
Oh, 100%. And I think, you know, the NCAA has worked more on the side of the student athlete in this case. I think in terms of the waivers, because like I mentioned, they've granted almost 80% of the waivers. So I think that their understanding of that, and when it comes to even creating this transfer portal, the idea was that, you know, a coach can't block a player from going to school X anymore, that the player just needs to notify the compliance department, put his name in the portal, and then he can get in there. So I think this is more NCAA student athlete friendly than anything. But what I would say to that, to your point, is, I'm surprised that the coaches aren't more thoughtful of that. That, you know, they move around a lot and the coaching carousel happens, and they know as well as anybody that when in the recruiting process, that sure, the school and the academics can be a factor, and, you know, the environment, the campus and whatever. But I would say 99% of the recruits that I talk to, when I ask them, why did you choose this school, or what sold you on this school? 99% of the time, they say it's a level of comfort and it's the relationships that I built, whether it's with the coaching staff or the players or whatever. And really, you know, this is sales. Before I did this in another life, I was in sales, and sales is about relationship building, and it's about getting someone to trust you and making them feel comfortable to make a decision. And these are grown men, adults, trying to sell recruits on their program and why they should come to that program. And so it's definitely about the coaches, and it's definitely about that relationship that you have and that comfort level. And you mentioned scheme, how they fit into that type of environment. Because if you bring it, if you commit to a coach, sign, get on campus, spend a year or two with that coach, build those relationships, and then he leaves and a new staff comes in, it could be a completely different environment, something that you didn't sign up for, that now you're not comfortable with. So, that whole charade of a kid should commit to a school, and even, I hear from the fans all the time that this kid should be loyal to this school. It's like, I don't get that at all, because it's a kid trying to get to the NFL. It's a kid trying to accomplish his dreams. I don't know where the loyalty would come in when he's been there for a year or less in some cases, that he should be loyal to that program.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. Tom Van Haren is my guest, ESPN college football and recruiting reporter, does a terrific job. Early signing period and National Signing Day, where are we at with this? It used to be National Signing Day, boy, it was magical. We couldn't wait for that day to see who's going where, and now it's turned into a bit of a Broadway show, whether it's National Signing Day or the early signing period with the hats and the magic tricks and everything but bands are getting signed up. But more importantly, does National Signing Day, Tom, does it still carry the same weight and significance because of that 65 to 72-hour period in mid-December?
No, signing day in February has changed drastically from what it used to be, and it's crazy to think, because it's really, this is just the second year of this early signing period. And I think last year in the 2018 recruiting class, for that first initial early signing period in December, I think it was that one was just a feeling out process, where for coaches and recruits and even us, we were, as reporters trying to figure out what was going to happen. And I remember talking to a lot of coaches before that first early signing period. And I asked them, do you guys have a plan? Do you know what's going to happen? Do you have a strategy? And a lot of them said the same thing. We've got a plan, but we don't know if it's going to work. And so I think that initial early signing period, everybody was feeling their way through. And then we got to this one this year, and it seemed that there was a better strategy, a more confident strategy from the coaching staffs. They knew what to expect, and they knew what they needed to do. And from talking to a lot of the coaches, the overall sentiment, the overall message was that most of the programs, most of the coaches were treating that December signing period as the only signing period. That if you're committed to our program and you don't sign in December, then we're probably going to view you as you're not committed, and we're going to go try to fill that spot with somebody else. Now, that's not everybody. Not everybody has that luxury of being able to do that. But the majority of coaches that I spoke with said that. And, that was not just coach speak, because after that early signing period, we were only left with 41 ESPN 300 prospects who were unsigned, which was it was incredible. It was a rise up from – I believe from 2018 to 2019, we saw in 2018 it was 221 of the ESPN 300 prospects signed in December, and then in 2019 it was 260, I believe, somewhere around there. So it was an increase in the number of prospects that signed early. And the coaches, they said, we're going to treat this as the only signing period. And then in January, we're going to move on to the 2020 class. And that's really what we saw this year.
Last thing. Those are pretty telling numbers. Last thing for you. We've got about a minute here. Do you see a point where National Signing Day, because of what you just said and the trend over the last couple of years, could potentially get phased out?
I don't think it'll be phased out altogether, because you still have the top ranked guys, the elite level guys at certain positions, premium positions, who are going to want to wait and want to wait till February to make that decision. And you're also going to have prospects that are still leery of coaching changes and want to wait that out. So I think we're going to see an increase in the early signing period, but it will not phase out the February signing period either.
Well, listen, folks, doesn't get any better than this, having Tom Van Herren on. And I want to remind you, his outstanding book, The Road to Ann Arbor, Incredible Twists and Improbable Turns Along the Michigan Recruiting Trail, written, of course, by Tom Van Herren. I strongly suggest you pick that up. It's great reading. Tom, it's been a while since we've had you on. It's always a great pleasure. I hope you come back.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm happy to come back whenever.
Absolutely.
Talk to you soon.
Wonderful. Tom Van Herren in Detroit, Michigan. It's very cold there. It's very snowy there. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
One more thing for you today in our final 90 seconds or so. I think Tom Van Herren put a great button on everything, talking about the transfer portal. I do think that coaches are, I'm not going to say needlessly worried, but I think the concern that college football will turn into what amounts to a de facto free agency is a little misguided and maybe an overreaction, because players do commit to a coach, and if you're going to Clemson, you're going to Alabama, and you're that level of recruit, it's more than likely that you're going there to play and stay at those places, unless your circumstances change, like they did with Kelly Bryant, when suddenly you lose your job to a Trevor Lawrence, and so you look for somewhere else to go. But if coaches can do it, players should be able to do it. Players should have the same latitude as coaches. And why not test and measure? I like to use that phrase, because why not continue to broaden the latitude that players have for transferring? And then if it does get out of hand, if it gets to be too much, then you create some new rules or some new guidelines, parameters, tighten the parameters a little bit to reshape it. But don't assume that something's going to happen. Make a stand and say, we're going to let players do this. We're going to give them a little bit more latitude. That's the way that I would go. My thanks to Tom Van Herren and Cam Morrell, Pete Lopes, Tony D, my guy Russ doing his usual great job, and all of you folks. We will see you in 21 hours. Until then, you're on your own.